The video
yes.
The organization had put together?
So I work with young people at SAYA, which is South Asian Youth Action, and last year they made a video to address some of these issues. Part of what the video talks about is detentions, deportations, hate crimes against Muslims and South Asians, and it also gives them a voice to speak about that. At the time, this was like last year, and at the time the media wasn't really reporting about these issues, and there were a lot of misconceptions about immigrants, about South Asians, about Muslims, and for our young people it was an opportunity to speak to that. So
let's go to the tape.
Yeah.
Towers burning, so I thought like something is going on.
Two buildings I just saw like the day before are just gone, so
I saw that with my own eyes, people flying down, all the smoke. I know what happened. All right, I feel for all those lost souls and lives over there too.
I'm sorry for the loss of WTC, but it wasn't my fault. Why are you blaming me?
Listen, I can show y'all how this all is boat stairs. Prior to September 11th, the common criminal was a black man with baggy pants. Now it's the turban-wearing guy with a full beard. Now I'm ahead in disgust watching vengeful citizens attack helpless innocents and perform acts of belligerence on South Asian immigrants.
I see heads covered with stripes and stars instead of Muslim head coverings known as hijabs. I've fallen worse than the twins themselves, but no one's helping me up, because supposedly I belong in a jail cell.
Interested in one aspect of this video. We've all gone around and we've talked about, you know, what is the state of the domestic war, and we've said a lot of things that I think that a progressive audience, people that listen, for example, to WBAI, that watch Eminem, have heard, that this war has been going on for a while, that immigrants are being targeted wholesale, et cetera, et cetera. But I feel like there are a couple of issues that we're skirting around, and I really want to pull on one piece that was addressed by a young man in the video that was shot by SAYA. He talked about the connection between the black man in the baggy pants and the turban terrorist. And I want to actually hone in on that connection, because I feel like we don't approach it enough. The black man with the baggy pants is an image that we typically consider to be a criminal. It's a person that you cross the street away from because you're afraid of getting mugged. It's the one that you imagine raping white women. The terrorist, the turban terrorist, is the new culprit, is the new sort of enemy of the state. It's the one that you want to deport out of this country, to detain and exile, because that's the one that caused the towers to fall. These are the images that we're playing with. I don't think that we talk enough, however, about how these images intersect concretely and legally, the intersections between this stuff. So I want to put a little bit of information out here and then hopefully plunge into a bit of conversation. I think that many of the viewing audience and a lot of us here don't realize that the fastest growing segment of the deported population is actually people with criminal convictions. The government has been targeting... The government has been targeting people with criminal convictions, non-citizens with criminal convictions, especially since 1996. It didn't start with the war on terrorism. The logic is actually it started with the war on drugs. So what's interesting about the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, for example, is it expanded the grounds of deportation for green card holders with criminal convictions. So for example, you could be someone who'd lived in the U.S. since you were 6 months old, had a green card, had family here, maybe U.S. citizen family even. And let's say you got arrested one day. You're walking down the street. Maybe you have a joint on you. Who knows? Officer stops you. The officer stops you, by the way, possibly because you're a person of color. So there's a little bit of racial profiling going on in there. But the officer stops you, pulls you into criminal court. In criminal court, you're advised to plead guilty to a crime because that's the way the criminal court works. About 75% of guilty pleas in New York, for example, are settled through guilty plea. So you're taken into this system. You're advised to plead guilty. You take that plea. Maybe you're given 2 months. Maybe you just get community service. Who knows? When that stuff is up, though, you get taken into detention. That's when you're told, is when the INS agent, or now the, you know, the Department of Homeland Security agent, is picking you up. You get taken into detention, and you get processed for deportation. By law, because of the laws passed in 1996, you are mandatorily deportable. That means that you could go before an immigration judge. The judge could look at you and say, you're a straight-A student. You're Christ. Doesn't matter who you are, but you're going to get kicked out of the country. And no amount of crying for mom or dad or your brother or sister, your wife, your seven children is going to matter. That's one reality I want to put out there that I think that we need to now start connecting to September 11th, the war on terrorism. The other thing that I want to put out there is Patriot 2. I'm not sure how many of you all have heard of Patriot 2, but it's this new, big, terrible legislation, right? As Chi-Sun was mentioning, what's been happening a whole lot is that this country is seeing the loss of a balance of powers, right? What we're seeing is the Department of Justice, the executive branch, giving the middle finger to the other branches and saying, we are going to do what we want to do right now. We have the leverage to do it. So Patriot 2 was this draft bill that was actually written within the Department of Justice that's supposed to basically be the new big and bad law to protect the United States. A key component of Patriot 2 that doesn't get talked about enough is the immigration actions that take part that happen in Patriot 2. Stuck on to the very end of that act, there are a whole bunch of provisions that redefine yet again detention and deportation. And one of the key provisions talks about upping the criminal penalties for certain fraud violations. What I found really interesting about reading that is I thought about September 11th roundups. I thought about the people that were getting picked up after September 11th and how a lot of them were charged with civil immigration matters, overstaying a visa, carrying false documents, maybe some identity fraud here and there. But they never got brought into criminal court for it. What Patriot 2 proposes to do, however, is take these people, bring them into criminal court, process them through that, and then deport them as criminal aliens. So those are two things that are going on, multiple fronts in which the government is now trying to actually use the criminal justice system alongside the detention and deportation system to kick people out. I wanted to put that bit of information out there and then ask a few pointed questions to you all about something I've noticed, for example, in the work that goes on regionally against special registration, is that there's always this caveat about the people getting detained, about the people having to register. These are innocent people. These are not criminals. That's in a lot of the messaging out there. And what I find dangerous about that messaging is that, in fact, the government is using the criminal justice system, redefining laws to make people criminals. So one thing I want to ask people that are actively organizing against this work, for example, is how do you confront this reality about what the government strategy is in terms of your own organizing work, and how do you help your allies, immigrant communities, people of color communities, overcome the, you know, the discrimination we have towards people, for example, that come out of the criminal justice system?
Okay, so I'll start off. When DRUM initially launched our INS detention work several years ago, long before September 11th, one of the main reasons we started doing that work was because it was an issue that deeply affected South Asians in New York. But beyond that, there was very little work happening in New York, basically organizing from the communities affected themselves. There was a lot of sort of advocacy and legal organizations and faith-based sort of initiatives. But I think one of the reasons that the messaging has developed that way over the past, you know, 5 to 10 years is because that leadership from people directly affected was not necessarily there. When you look at the communities that are affected, there are very real linkages between, you know, where people are working and issues around like day-to-day things like healthcare and housing and education and the fact that, you know, our kids are more likely to end up in prisons or detention than in colleges. And so there's much more clear linkages between what happens to people of color communities affected by prisons and what happens to immigrant communities. But what happens on a larger level is, I think, the community, in some ways, the communities get sold out by what is, you know, winnable in the short term. So if you frame immigration as an issue of, you know, the innocents versus the guilty people, you know, who are in criminal jails or, you know, criminal detainees, it's easier to win your short-term sort of, you know, demands around, okay, well, let's, you know, have asylum seekers or you know, people who are refugees get out and not be affected by detention. But in the long term, what we end up doing is hurting each other. What we end up doing is making it harder to make the connections between why are asylum seekers there in the first place? Why are more and more communities being criminalized and more policies being created to do that? So we really actively work with communities affected by prisons to make those links and with criminal detainees. I mean, there's a lot of folks, you know, who won't address criminal detainee issues because of that, you know, divide and sort of that mentality.
I generally agree with what you guys are talking about, but there is an important distinction to be made between people who are convicted of crimes and people who are going through immigration proceedings. And the distinction is that people who are convicted of crimes are accorded legal rights by our legal system that people who are going through deportation proceedings do not have. So if you're convicted of if you're charged with a crime, you're going to be told that you have certain rights. You're going to be read your Miranda rights. You're going to be given a court-appointed lawyer. And we all know that the criminal justice system is, you know, not great. But at the same time, there is a difference between that and what people who are going through deportation proceedings are going through, where in most cases they're unfamiliar with the system in this country. In most cases, in many cases, English isn't their first language. In every case, they're not entitled to a government-funded lawyer to assist them to navigate that process. And so they're just railroaded through the system, and then they're gone, right? They're not a presence. We don't hear about a million people who went through immigration proceedings and are now jailed in the United States, because those people are out of the country. And I think that while the issues are connected, it's important to keep in mind the differences between the two.
I do feel, though, that, like, especially working with young people, I think that there are a lot of ways in which we're encouraged to draw these distinctions, right, between, okay, that's an issue that affects criminals, that's an issue that affects, you know, non-U.S. citizens. And so I feel like, for example, even within, like, the South Asian community, right, like, even though deportation and INS detention is an issue that now is the first thing you think about when you think about the South Asian community, I feel like even within the South Asian community, there are a lot of people who have green cards, who have U.S. citizenship, and don't necessarily feel like that's our issue anymore, right? And so I think working with young people is like, how can you use September 11th and that experience of personal attack, not necessarily to harp on it and keep, you know, rehashing it, but use it as a foundation to be like, this is what can create solidarity with these other people. Like, okay, we're no longer feeling threatened, but our community is being attacked. And these are issues that are still really relevant. And whether or not it's an immigrant issue, whether or not it's a, you know, you committed a crime issue, it's still an unjust system that is attacking people that look like us, you know, and people who are our families and our brothers and sisters, and to never forget that. Even though I think a lot of times that people want to forget that because we don't want to feel like it's us, you know, like we want to draw these distinctions and be like, that's them, this is us, even within our own community sometimes.
I'm very curious about Chi-sun. You've done a lot of coverage of detention and deportation issues and previously racial profiling issues, and I'm really curious about how you view the work going on against these systems, because you seem to have a lot of contact with activists and organizers, and also what you think of sort of ethnic media coverage of these issues, what's lacking, what's not there, what is there, corporate media coverage, just, you know, some sort of, I guess, preliminary impressions you have.
Okay. Well, I'm not an expert on ethnic media coverage, but there's just obviously a more intense interest in ethnic newspapers focusing on certain immigrant communities. So I think that certain INS policies and just developments get reported out in more detail. But in terms of covering some of this stuff, I think the point that Shoaib raised about information access, if you've got a criminal case going on versus an immigration case, I have found in my experience calling up the INS or what it's now the BICE for comment on a case of an immigrant detainee that I'm writing about, the answer is almost invariably, I can't comment. It's an immigration matter. I can't comment. But sometimes in the beginning, when it was closer to September 11th, the answer was sometimes this is a national security matter. I can't comment from the INS. But when you have a criminal case, there are court records. There are, you know, ostensibly arguments made in open court. And there's a little bit more fair play in terms of reporting out both sides of the story. So it's a trade-off, though. But then the person in question has this criminality attached to him or her. But in terms of information access, from a reporter's perspective, that's a criminal case is often just easier to report more fairly, you know, both sides of the story.
I guess what I'm actually, let me refine the question that I'm asking. I'm not so much talking about coverage of criminal justice system versus immigration detention system, which are becoming more and more similar, actually, over time. You've seen the development of them on parallel tracks. But what I'm talking about more is within the immigration detention system, you have all sorts of detainees. So, for example, you have asylum seekers. Those are people who came to the United States, and when they got to the airport, they said, I'm here fleeing persecution. I'm afraid of going back. I might be killed. Whammo, detention. That's one person that ends up there. Another person you're talking about is your straight-up undocumented folk, maybe someone in the audience right now, maybe your next-door neighbor, someone who overstayed a visa, someone that crossed the border, someone who has no papers and could get kicked out at any moment. That's another person we're talking about. Then this other type of person we're talking about could be someone, for example, who has a green card that's lived here legally for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, but had contact with the criminal justice system, even a first-time nonviolent offense, and is going to be deported because of these 1996 laws that I referred to. That's sort of the population in detention by and large. And that includes a sort of special category of post-September 11th detainees, which is ambiguous in some ways and becoming more and more ambiguous because now everyone technically is a post-September 11th detainee. But I'm really curious about how you as a journalist look at the sort of divisions within this population, whether they're prominent divisions within your own mindset, within the coverage that you see. You know, what lip service, what, you know, what validity do they have when you're talking about these issues?
Well, I really think, I mean, largely with any story, for me at least, it's on a case-by-case basis. So that's for one. I can't really make generalizations about different populations. But what I hear you getting at is sort of how do these levels of this sort of criminal labels put on different segments of the immigrant population govern how reporters might approach different stories, like, you know, putting different degrees of validity on one detainee's story versus another. And it's, you see it, it's very difficult if you have to report both sides of the story, and the government side of the story is this person is a criminal, and you have to put that into the story, but to sort of get under that and look at the layers of what that means, you need to be able to get information. And that's what this Justice Department will not give reporters. They will not let reporters into a number of immigration hearings. I'm sure they don't let a lot of you guys, activists and advocates, into certain immigration hearings. They will not tell reporters how many immigrants have been detained on so-called terrorism-related charges. And I think that the lack of information access can't be stressed enough. I think for the press, for advocates, you know, what you're asking me to do, sort of give a picture of how I gauge trends in immigrant detention, is very hard to say because of the lack of information that's coming down. For reporters, and you know, it doesn't matter whether you're in the alternative media, although it can be more challenging, but you've got the New York Times and the Washington Post in court on freedom of information. actions against the Justice Department. And it's difficult to know for any of us exactly what is going on. So, you know, immigrant community groups, activist groups are a major source of information for me. You know, you guys are the experts. You've been doing this since before 9/11, and you've been watching changes just even by word of mouth in the communities post 9/11. And that's a lot more information coming to us in the media than is coming down from the government, really. So in some ways, you know, that's a strength. Just information coming out of communities, people weighing the risks and coming forward with stories and helping to give reporters and the public some sense of trends, you know, and who the real people are behind these policies that we hear about from Ashcroft.
I think within the mainstream media, the coverage around immigration stuff has been very one-sided and very obscure. It's made a whole another group of folks of color and just like folks in general fear immigrants. It started the whole, you know, just basically U.S. propaganda spurred at you constantly about these folks are terrorists, you know. I mean, has anybody ever seen that commercial on TV where they show like young kids, if you buy marijuana, you're a terrorist, you're helping terrorists. Everything's basically a terrorist. So basically, if you're of color and from another country, you are a terrorist. And that's exactly how the mainstream media has been framing this. Of course, you know, this few rays of light that comes out and gives a okay, not too problematic side of a story, but generally everything else that comes out is very much concentrated on immigrants who are criminals. They take that and they run with it. You never know why this person committed a crime. You never hear how long it was ago. Because, you know, you have people, I know a couple of cases that were in the media about immigrants who were being deported who had committed a crime, and the crime was like 15, 20 years ago. It was something small like marijuana or like, you know, visa fraud or whatever, you know what I'm saying? So the mainstream media very much sets the tone for the U.S. to do a whole variety of other things, whether it's, you know, passing these unfair and unjust laws around immigration, or where it's, you know, basically giving somebody the justification to go out and commit a hate crime. Because that's where a lot of that comes from. It comes through fear, and it comes through the media's propaganda that no matter what you do, you hear about it in some shape or form, whether it's about post 9/11 or about the war in Iraq.
Do you guys think that immigrant communities actually feel under attack right now? Something that really, really struck me about sort of, there have been rallies in front of Federal Plaza against special registration, right, which is that special Department of Justice policy created so that Arab, Muslim, South Asian men of 33 countries and North Korea who are 16 years old have to go and like check themselves in, right? So there were these rallies around there. And I saw what amazed me were lines and lines of people going into Federal Plaza, immigrants, people that may not have papers yet, people who aren't citizens, looking at the protest and sort of, I think, critical of what was going on and not really feeling themselves a part of it. And so I'm really curious about your impressions about, we talk about this as immigrant communities under attack, as an immigrant problem, but is there that collective sense there yet? And if not, how do we foster that?
I mean, just because of special registration, I've talked to people, predominantly Pakistani, Bangladeshi, and Indonesian people from around the country. And the things that they tell me across those three communities and across the country are remarkably similar in terms of the amount of fear that they feel, in terms of the state of the people that I've talked to feel persecuted now in a way that they didn't even, particularly the Bangladeshi and Indonesian communities that weren't as targeted as the Pakistani community a few months ago. They talk about how everything changed, and I've seen stuff in the ethnic media that said the same thing, where everything changed on December 18th, when we were included in the special registration list. And, you know, I don't necessarily agree with that point of view, but I do think that there has been a shift in the consciousness of people. There were not Indonesian people fleeing to Canada before 2 months ago, and now there are. And I think that there is a real fear. Whether the activism has been able to organize folks on the basis of that fear is an entirely different question, I think. But I think immigrant communities, at least the communities that we're talking about, that have been specifically targeted after September 11th, they really do feel persecuted and under attack, at least the people that I've talked to.
I mean, my perspective is a little different because I feel like within our community there is a great deal of diversity, right? And so I think for some people, new laws get enacted every day that target them. And so they suddenly realize, oh, wait, that's me, right? I think for other people, however, like especially when you're talking about young people, right? Like not just Muslim and South Asian and Arab young people, but young people across the board, I feel, on some level, one sentiment I hear a lot is that we're kind of like September 11th doubt, right? Like we don't want to talk about these issues anymore. We're kind of tired of all of this hype and all of this, just all of this discussion. And so I think that on some level, there is not necessarily a backlash, but like an exhaustion about talking about these topics. And so I think people are really eager to distance themselves sometimes from these discussions, especially if they and their families and their loved ones are not directly impacted. And so I think, just in terms of like me, like I think a really big part of my work is to always make this relevant, you know, to be like, September 11th, you could see that relevance, right? But INS special registration policies, if you're a, you know, U.S. passport carrying member of society, like you may not see that connection immediately, but it's my job to draw those connections, to draw the connections between us and immigrants, to draw the connection between, you know, South Asians and African Americans and Latinos, and to really talk about those connections, because I feel like sometimes, yeah, like I don't necessarily feel like everyone feels under attack all the time, even though, as I've said, I feel like we are.
I think I understand and I agree with you on some of that. Mm-hmm. A lot of the young people we work with, I think, also sort of say the same similar things. Mm-hmm. And they're mostly new immigrants, South Asian young people. But I think one of the reasons for that is because the only spaces that they have to talk about it, whether it's in, you know, hearing about it in the mainstream media or in their school systems, it's not an empowering conversation.
True.
It's usually a conversation that sort of, you know, victimizes communities or forces certain communities to start telling people that we are not terrorists, we are not evil, and Muslims are not bad, and explain Islam. And that's really disempowering, mm-hmm. and it completely misses the point. And I think what it does for our communities is it forces us into a position of defending ourselves rather than standing up for, you know, what our rights are and standing up for the services and the respect and dignity that our communities deserve. I think that there is definitely distancing from certain segments of immigrant communities. Because immigrant communities, like any other community, is not homogenous. It's not all the same. I mean, in the South Asian community, there's people here who migrated 20, 30 years ago who are citizens, who, you know, are professional class people, who want to distance themselves from undocumented people and low-wage and no-wage workers who have come in the last 10 to 15 years. And that's definitely, that's a component that's been used by the Department of Justice to basically, like, divide and conquer within immigrant communities. One of the ways that we've seen this happen is that there's sort of this picking and choosing going on of who are the legitimate voices of the Muslim community, of the Arab community, of the South Asian community. And usually those legitimate voices are voices that will mimic and say the same things that the mainstream media and, you know, policymakers want to be said. You know, they're the voices that are telling our community members to go and check in with the FBI and contact your law enforcement agents, where the reality for most low-income people who are affected by these policies is that law enforcement has always historically been against them, has always racially profiled. So I think that, you know, particularly for low-income immigrant communities and immigrant workers, this stuff is not new. This is, you know, this has been happening to our communities for a long, long time. I think it has politicized other segments, mm-hmm. more professional classes of immigrant communities, and I think this is a moment to try to use that rather than try to, you know, rather than let those divisions really work against us.
What does it take for the work that we do, for the media coverage of this work, to start reflecting the realities of it? What I'm really curious about is what does it take, for example, for Dominican groups that are directly facing detention and deportation, and there are lots of them, especially in New York area. What does it take for Dominicans to start having dialogue with Pakistanis? You know, what does that take? When is it going to happen that Coney Island Avenue and Flatbush, a Pakistani neighborhood and a Caribbean neighborhood, start talking with one another about the fact that they're all going through the same jails? I mean, is it that we have to confront our own racism?
Is it that there's misinformation out there? Is it that we're speaking to the wrong issues? What's going on?
Well, I'm from Flatbush. I was born there and raised there. And, you know, I think one of the real things that's going to take is to get our message out. Because, you know, I mean, while just like what one of you said, while we're facing this, you know, you're not as open to talk about these issues in a large setting like you would have been a couple of years ago, because it's that evident fear of deportation, of, you know, being criminalized, of being locked up. And I also think it takes major, you know, hitting the streets. It definitely takes folks getting out there, holding safe spaces, you know, to really bring these people together and bridging these issues. You know, when we talk about immigration, we have to definitely always be broad. But, you know what I'm saying, when we talk about that, we definitely have to mention the Caribbean folks. We definitely have to mention, you know, the whole variety of things that are happening within our communities to really pull them together. Because if we don't pull them together, that's enables the government to do exactly what it's doing right now, divide and conquer. Because there's so many things that they put in place to keep us separated, whether it be certain statutes on different countries around deportation, or whether it be just, you know, nonsense propaganda that the U.S. put out there. So it definitely takes a lot of outreach, and it takes even programs like this one to inform people and to plug people in, because a lot of people don't know that there's organizations like Desi's Rising Up and Movement, or Prison Moratorium Project, or so on and so forth. A lot of people don't know about this, so it's definitely about letting them know that we exist, and people do have the same thoughts that you're thinking right now, and coming together, not in being as one, but at least in solidarity and understanding that we're all going through the same issues.
From the media's perspective, or from my standpoint, I can't write about something going on unless I know about it. And so it's easy for me to say, well, come and tell me what's going on so that I can have an opportunity to write about it. But it's much harder on the other side of that when it's become more risky with the passing months to speak out for certain folks. So I think that it's important to keep tabs on the trend that's going on. You mentioned Patriot Act 2, which is right now just a draft proposal of new legislation the Justice Department might want to seek to expand its powers more. But in that draft of a law are buried a bunch of things that will chill free speech even more than it's been chilled now on all kinds of levels. Obviously, undocumented immigrants are the most vulnerable because they can be detained indefinitely and there are just fewer legal protections. But you hear even about, you know, leftist lawyers who are on the federal airport's no-fly list. They'll show up at the airport and they'll be found and pulled aside and have problems flying. So there's this roster of policies and practices that work to silence the most vulnerable and make it harder for the people who have more power, who might be more natural allies, to speak when the most vulnerable can't come forward to a newspaper and speak. And, you know, it's a big problem because I can't write about what I don't know. But then at the same time, there is a hunger for information, I think especially in the mainstream media. Somehow I've ended up on a lot of immigrant issues, listservs, different community listservs, and I see often these emails going out on the listserv saying, oh, a reporter from this mainstream newspaper or from this TV station desperately wants a spokesperson to come forward and talk about, you know, hate crimes or immigration detention. And so there's obviously, a certain demand for information and a disconnect between the communities who are most impacted and could speak with the most authority and the biggest outlets of the news. Mm-hmm. And how to bridge that, you know, that's not my area of expertise, but I recognize when I ask for stories and ask for people to reveal very vulnerable information, that, you know, what I can get to put into a story is something that might put somebody at some risk. And so that's a major thing to weigh, but at the same time I think public awareness is a huge component of people even knowing what's going on in communities. I mean, you know, you were talking about this line outside of the INS office where it was hard to tell what some people were even thinking, looking on at a protest that is ostensibly to protect their rights. And I'm very skeptical as a reporter when I encounter silence from somebody who is under attack or in a vulnerable spot. I know myself just from having immigrant parents that often the safest road seems to be to, you know, keep quiet and say everything's cool, especially to a newspaper reporter. But it takes a very delicate dynamic to draw out the truth enough to achieve public awareness but not, you know, radically endanger the person who's come forward to talk.
I also think that, like, what I can kind of speak to is some of the stuff that we try to do at SIA, right, which is really try to foster that dialogue between different groups. And so I think because we work with young people, we have, like, an emphasis on creative outlets for that, right? So to have youth speak outs where a diverse group get together and meet each other, right, and have actual conversations and to have open mics and to have creative ways of, A, expressing a voice rather than just a newspaper account, but also to actually have a voice, because I feel like sometimes our stories are told, but our voices are, like, our literal voices are missing. And so I think for young people, especially, like, through youth conferences, through open mics, through newsletters, through artwork, through spoken word, everything, there are a bunch of different ways to not only have to empower them to share their voice, but to actually create settings where diverse groups of young people can see each other and learn from each other instead of, well, having an adult be like, this is the connections between us, but to actually go there, experience it, and feel it.
I think that's one of the key issues, and I think the whole question about the media and then why our communities are not connecting with each other mm-hmm. comes into play, is that there's so many few spaces for, you know, vulnerable, particularly immigrant and people of color communities, to come together on our own terms. On our own terms, meaning without media people watching, without politicians watching and wanting a piece of it, or, you know, without there being, you know, strings attached. And given the climate of fear right now, that there really is a need to for organizing within communities for self-determination. Whatever those communities see as the most important issues in the short term and the long term, to talk about that openly with each mm-hmm. other without the fear of, you know, all these sort of outside forces wanting something out of it. And I think that fear is so real. I mean, in the past year and a half, we've had so many of our members be visited by FBI agents, be questioned. You know, people who were undocumented or going through a process of trying to get citizenship, their whole lives depend on it. You know, they're struggling before September 11th. And within that, they're trying to organize. So for our constituency, it's not those people who are going to come at the forefront of rallies and, you know, shout and mm-hmm. scream in front of TV cameras. They do the work. I mean, they're there every day in offices, in their homes, doing outreach, on phone calls, talking to people in detention. They're doing a lot of the invisible work. They just cannot afford to risk their lives to do the visible work. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, that doesn't mean that it's not impacting them.